There's a big topic I want to discuss, and that's right-wing cancel culture. We had a debate about this with our friend and colleague, Trav LeBlanc, at Countercurrents, and David took up another side praising right-wing cancel culture. Angelo, you have some sympathy to the things that Trav was saying, so maybe you could stand in for Trav and we could have this discussion again. One of the things that happened after the Trump assassination is shit libs were gloating about this and saying, I wish the guy had better aim. I wish he were dead. Blah, blah, blah. Corey Comparadori was a bad man. He drank whole milk and didn't believe in vaccines. He didn't follow the things on the TV. He deserved to die. That kind of shit. These people are vicious. They're monstrous. They want the people who disagree with them dead. And people got angry. And they have started going after people who have come out signaling in favor of Trump's death. And this is a beautiful thing, in my opinion. I like to see people with a fighting spirit. But there are counter arguments against this as well. Some people say it's inconsistent with our principles. Others say it's bad optics and strategically bad idea. Trav laid out his arguments. David laid out his counter arguments. So let's talk about that. And folks out there, if you have questions and comments related to right-wing cancel culture, chime in with those as well.
Okay, so I guess I'll start because I'll take Trav's position more or less. I did like what he wrote, and I think he made some good points. Right off the bat, I'll just say that I'm all about pragmatism. I'm all about being Machiavellian and winning and always keeping the friend-enemy distinction in mind. So, first of all, for me personally, I'm not about to extend an olive branch. One of the things that I didn't like in the wake of this right-wing cancel culture, which I also accept the point that it was being sort of, it was instigated by the Jewess who runs Libs of TikTok, and she's going around basically, you know, doxing and hall monitoring libtards. And I get that people have a problem with her leading the way on this. Now, for me personally, so everyone was starting to say, look, or many people were starting to say that this is hypocrisy. She's just a Home Depot cashier. What are you doing going after her, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, there was coming from the elites talk of unity and coming together and toning down the tensions that we've been boiling in for so long. I'm not about to extend an olive branch, not at all. So I don't think we should be magnanimous and take the moral high ground and extend an olive branch. I don't think that. But I do like LeBlanc's points about picking your battles. And he does say that if the right is going to try and cancel people only because every once in a blue moon, there's this black swan event that is to our advantage, it's not really an effective, pragmatic, and winning strategy. You're not really doing that much to your enemies. And because of the right's anti-cancel culture position for such a long time, it does look a bit silly. It does kind of smell bad. Now, that's not to say that I'm moral fagging on this. I think we should crush our enemies. So, but when he's saying, you know, you can't play this game just every once in a while, and he is right to say that we don't have the institutional backing to be able to cancel people. And Millennial Woes also wrote something really good on this. Cancel culture isn't a bottom-up phenomenon. People don't, liberals actually, who debate amongst themselves where this cancel culture thing even exists, when they see fit to admit that it does, they totally misunderstand it. They think it's akin to boycotting. They think it's akin to a bottom-up populist rejection of a person. It's not. It's a top-down excising. It's a top-down exiling of a person, and not from being able to sell their products or be famous, but from being able to have power and influence. And so the right doesn't really have the ability to do that to anyone. So it's not really the best, most pragmatic position to take. If we could, and Trav says this in his piece, you know, if you could cancel Tim Wise, Rachel Maddow, Emmanuel Macron, you know, that would be great. That would be a suitable application of this kind of rather Jewish mediatic and cultural warfare, snitching on people, getting them canceled, whipping up this moral melodrama. It's all very, very Jewish, which is why, you know, we aren't that good at it. Not just on the right, but we who are not Jews on the right aren't very good at it. It's not really in our nature. So I think he does make some good points there. About choosing your targets, though, you know, people like a Home Depot cashier or the questioner who mentioned that these two Hispanics openly wished that Trump had died in this conversation he was having with them, you know, it. There's a distinction between true believers and then people who just want to have power. So they're riding this wave of wokeism or whatever. They're just opportunists. And then there's this other faction, the sort of the Home Depot cashier type faction, where, although they could be of other classes, they could be higher up in the classes as well. But it's basically the person that's neither a true believer in anti-whiteism, immigration, diversity, wokery, whatever you want to call it. They're neither a true believer, nor are they an opportunist just looking for ways to gain more power and exploit current social mores. They're simply people who go with the flow of their social circle. They're simply people who not really thinking about anything. They're just kind of going with what they perceive to be majority views. And so if you're from a liberal area, or if you have a liberal minded social circle, then you yourself will go along with, you know, what they're saying. Even if somewhere deep down, you might not agree, maybe deep down or not very deep down at all, you don't really believe that a man in a dress is a woman, or that women can have penises. You don't believe that. But maybe there's a bit of peer pressure, or simply you do want to just go with the flow. So you go along with these ideas. And it's the same with this reaction to the failed assassination. The member of Tenacious D, who you know, Jack Black offers his bandmate and friend a birthday cake and says, "Make a wish." And I guess his name is Kyle Gass or Glass. You know, he wished that don't miss next time. Don't miss Trump next time. I'm more convinced than not that he made that comment thinking he could get away with it. It's a laugh. It's a joke. And I'm in good company. I'm in the company of people who will laugh at that. And the broader culture will laugh at that. And there's no harm, no foul. But does he actually want Trump to die? Is he one of the perverse, evil people that we know exist? Maybe not. And maybe not that cashier either. It'd be interesting to see the cashier's, you know, internet history, the comments she's made. So with these people who are neither zealots or opportunists, I actually do think that they're fair targets, in the sense that we're having a staring competition. And if the left blinks first, we win. Now, how do you get them to blink? Well, they have to feel some sort of pressure. They have to feel some sort of discomfort. And LeBlanc argues that another reason why right-wing cancel culture isn't a good idea is that people who get canceled resent the side that cancels them. Now, that's true. That's a good observation. But something else happens. Sometimes people get canceled and they resent the side that they were on for putting them in that position where they could be canceled. This has actually happened to many people on our side. They get doxxed or canceled. There's not much of a network of support, which I think plays into the resentment. And so they hide away for a while. And then when they reemerge, they don't want anything to do with nationalism or alt-right politics or what have you. And they reject it and they reinvent themselves as a centrist or even a liberal. And part of that is because they feel resentment towards being on the side that got them in trouble. Now, if that could be done to people like Home Depot cashiers or, you know, empty-headed entertainers who I think don't really have many thoughts of their own to begin with, that actually I do find a pragmatic and Machiavellian strategy. Pushing back on liberal normies, low-level, you know, not Tim Wise, not Rachel Maddow type targets, but cashiers and Hispanics that you're chatting with, I think there is an argument to be made that if you push them a little bit, if you make them feel the fear, the discomfort, the frustration that we've had to feel, you know, if their bank accounts start getting frozen, if their social media accounts get suspended, if they get exposed and mocked and shunned and criticized so much that they have to make these, you know, teary-eyed apologies and publish these statements of contrition, I think that's good, actually, because I don't know how deeply these people even believe in the liberal dogmas of the day. But I do think they do need to be, you know, a little friction for them is okay, actually. So that's one part where I would disagree with Trav LeBlanc, but I thought he made some other good points.
I do think that, yeah, you can say, okay, well, the Home Depot lady, small fry, et cetera. What about people like Rachel Maddow, et cetera? Well, the longest journey begins with a single step. And we might be able to scale the heights of canceling people like Tim Wise and Rachel Maddow by stacking up the bodies of, you know, Hispanic workers and Home Depot ladies and things like that, metaphorically speaking, of course. And so I don't see any reason why this should be poo-pooed. I like to see people on the right with a fighting spirit. I enough is enough. These people, the left, are bullies. The left are bullies, and the way to make bullies behave is to bloody their nose. And if these people see, oh, there are consequences for being a total shithead, then they're going to be more polite. Jim Goad wrote an article about the time he spent in prison, and he said, you know, in prison, actually the people were politest in prison than anywhere else he'd ever experienced. Why? Well, because I guess if you're in prison, there's a credible threat of force that just comes built in to your persona, right? If you're in jail, you're probably not somebody to be trifled with, and you'd have to have a loose screw to be unnecessarily rude and confrontational to a guy in jail, especially if you don't know why he's there. And I think that having a bit of a hair trigger, a bit of a willingness to throw down when you are mistreated, a bit of willingness to engage in tit-for-tat violence, and this addresses the question of spite, a bit of willingness to risk one's self-interest even in the cause of justice is actually a very rational thing. And let me just talk about the spite thing, and then I want to go to David because he makes some really good points that are congruent with what we've been saying in his piece responding to Trav. Spite is a very dark and negative emotion. Practically all evil behavior that people engage in is born out of bitterness, right? If somebody feels like they have been mistreated and they don't get any justice and it curdles and embitters their souls, that becomes an excuse for them to do bad things. Why? Well, I'm going to cheat because people cheated me. I'm going to be a nasty bastard because people were treated me in a bad way and nobody came to my defense, right? That's a very, very common source of evil is to get bitter. And bitterness also gives rise to spiteful behavior where you basically, the phrase is cut off your nose to spite your face. Basically, it's an attempt to capture that spite breaks down your ability to behave in a rationally self-interested, calculating way. You know, at a certain point, somebody will push you and you will respond. And you might respond in a way that is excessive, hair-triggered, and seems to be entirely unconcerned with your own self-interest. And people say, well, that's going too far, right? Yeah, indeed, if you do it once, it's going too far. But if you adopt it as a policy, then in the long run, it becomes rational. So the point is that if you are willing to dispense with your calculations of rational self-interest, and when people really cross the line, you are willing to respond in a way that it may not be rational in your rational self-interest, and they learn that, they will be less likely to mess with you in the future. Thomas Hobbes talks about this. Hobbes had brilliant game theoretical abstraction, you know, exercises in Leviathan. And he talks about, you know, the man who is ready to draw his sword at any provocation will be left alone. Even though it's not rational to escalate that far, it is rational to the extent, in the particular circumstance, it might not be rational. In the long term, it is rational because you'll be left alone. Okay, let's apply this to the tit for tat that's going on with right-wing cancel culture. The left has been bullying people. And if we can take any opportunity where the stars align, and it might be a black swan event, it might not come along every day, and we might not have institutional advantages. Yeah, you know, let's just set that aside. If we take any opportunity that we can to engage in that tit for tat kind of behavior, what is the likely result? You know, Hobbes talks about life in the state of nature. What's life in the state of nature? It's a war of all against all. Nobody's safe. If you transgress against others, they will fight back against you, right? And the point is that it becomes so bloody. You know, life becomes solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short in a state of nature. Therefore, people will rationally want to get out of it into the state of civil society and accept rules. Now, what Trav is talking about, and what Trav is envisioning basically, is a world where there's no cancel culture. It's like the world of civil society where people have agreed to have rules where you don't do this. How do you get to that world? You don't get to that world by pretending that you're already in it and allowing people to trample you and not fight back in kind. You don't get the world you want by doing that. You don't get the world you want by extending olive branches to thugs. You don't get the world you want by being magnanimous and high-minded and posturing as if you already live in a world that you don't. That is just a way of getting ground under their wheels and taken advantage of. We are being bullied constantly, and we need to fight back. And if we fight back enough, these people will say, hey, wait a second here. Maybe it's all in our rational self-interest that we don't do this cancellation bullshit. Maybe we should have principles and rules. They're not going to accept that until their nose is bloodied over and over again and they give up the bullying. And they won't stay under those rules unless we have a constant readiness to fight back whenever they cross the line. So we just need to develop this kind of fighting spirit. And yeah, even in the case of small fry like this Home Depot lady, I'm happy to see that, because there have been, you know, the memes were great on this. You know, we shouldn't go after small fry, and then somebody puts the headline about the law enforcement guy, the policeman who was fired for donating $25 to Kyle Rittenhouse. I'm sorry, if that guy's getting canceled, the Home Depot lady's getting canceled too. And I don't think the asymmetry that's being pointed out by millennial woes really matters in this case. Yeah, they do it from the top down because they're the elites with power. We'll do it from the bottom up because we're the masses with pitchforks. Yeah, it's going to be harder for us, but we're never going to get out from under their boots until we start fighting back this way. So, David, what are your thoughts on this?
Yes, so I'm going to start with a point made that this is not a good target. It's not a good use of our time. Yeah, so, yes, I would agree at first glance we should be going after high targets, for we should go as high as we can. The problem is that those targets are hard. Now, if we can hit them, hit them. But if we can't hit them, you go after soft targets. Like in a war, you might want to go after the enemy headquarters, a general. Well, if you can't, go after a major. And usually you're just fighting their soldiers. That's the thing, too. That flows into another point, that these elites need willing soldiers. And the left was very happy to oblige them. The Home Depot lady wasn't just, you know, innocently repeating things like a stupid toddler that she heard on MSNBC. I know these types very well from personal experience. This was the person who was ordering people to wear a mask, who was a stickler for all that stuff, who was gloating about January 6th, who would report you for saying it's okay to be white. These people create a hostile work environment, unironically. These are not nice people. These people are problem makers. They're willing rainbow commissars. And the regime, for all their people always fixate on the World Economic Forum, whatever, let's say that's all true. They still need low-level people to carry that out. So the left, they might be the generals, but they need all these NCOs, all these people who are ringleaders to make it happy. And just like in real army, real military, you need the NCOs are the backbone to make everything work. I kid you not, E4 to E5 is like what makes the military function. I am biased in that regards because I was a staff sergeant, but regardless, other people agree too. The main issue here is that they need these people who are ringleaders, eager, willing rainbow commissars and NCOs for the leftist establishment. And she was one of them. I promise you, these people are not pleasant and they revel in power. And two, if we can't go after the big fish, we go after the small fish. That's how you go. That's something you do in mafia turf wars too. The little guys get hurt because until the bosses can go after each other. And two, I also made a point in my article about escalation, where we're starting from absolutely zero. We have to give our people a taste of victory, get them organized, and eventually this will get bigger and bigger. And another thing, I already discussed the cost in regards to legitimacy as not being an issue in the article. You can read it, but I want to bring up another issue about the cost of energy. So these people were posting on their real names, so to get them fired or harassed, it's like, requires minimal effort on our part. So it's very cost efficient. And even doxing leftists who are not under the real name, what's going on is that we have 4chan. We have a decentralized intelligence agency. And they're very eager and happy to do work. They're happy to volunteer their time. And so if they don't have any other big project going on, then why not? Now, if they have some super big secret project, like they're trying to create their own dissident bank, yeah, they shouldn't be doxing random cashiers. But if they're looking for a project, they have the time, this is something they can do. Another thing, too, is that doxing doesn't matter as much to leftists. It still matters. For example, Antifa really hates Andy Ngo for simply reporting on all their constant arrests, their names, their history, their faces. They've tried to kill him. That's how much it matters to them. And part of this is that they're just completely insane, they're on drugs, but no, they don't like it either. It makes them very uncomfortable because they fear that even if they don't suffer consequences today, they could suffer consequences in the future, one way or another. They're on a list now. And this is the thing, too, with doxing right-wing people. It's not as bad as you think it is, but you're still on a list. It's still kind of permanent, unless you do, like, super good. There are ways to kind of, like, make it disappear, but it's difficult. So, no, I think it is good. And I think even putting in more effort to dox hidden leftists is good. It will send them a message, and it will make them more scared. So, yes, it is cost-efficient, actually. And another thing, too, and Greg, should we discuss maybe the internal movement poll about the effects of doxing? Are we keeping that secret for now?
Yeah, you can go ahead and discuss that. I think that's actually something that's good to make public.
All right. So according to our poll, of the people who are doxed, about half of them had no consequences beyond initial anxiety. That's still a consequence. And so doxing, people say that, oh, it's a lot more difficult for right-wingers. Well, doxing actually in general is not that difficult. A lot of it has become weaker and weaker post-Charlottesville, post-January 6th. It's like, oh, you didn't storm the Capitol. Who cares? Well, like, so there's no dead body that can point to. For example, whenever they try to dox people in regards to Charlottesville, always be in regards to the devil, unite the right rally, the martyrdom of Saint Heather Heifer. Well, there's no dead body to point to, and you didn't storm the Capitol, which was pretty funny. So they're less powerful now. So doxing in general is not this horrible thing. Now, and we can edit this out and cut me off if I shouldn't say this, but a quarter did have employment consequences of some time, either permanent or either ongoing or temporary. That's something to seize on. That's still an issue. But still, only a quarter. That's not as bad as you think it is. Like the left wing people who dox right wing people want to make it seem like the sky's falling. It's not falling. And two, there are other issues like miscellaneous problems. Well, again, the sky isn't falling. These are all things you can deal with. You lost friends; they weren't your real friends. Law enforcement contacts you. That's basically an intimidation method. Don't be intimidated. Move on. So that's good stuff. And the social stuff might hurt the left more than hurts us because they're very more emotional about this. Movement people are more like cold, rational, so they didn't care anyways. They're prepared to lose friends over this. They're not invited to the wine bar to make tasteful banter, as Bap would say. I'm stealing that line from his because he stole our culture. I can steal his lines. This is no big loss. For them, the social stuff might be a big loss, and that includes
Hold on. Can I jump in a second, though?
Yeah.
The left isn't going to lose. No one on the left is going to lose social dignity or social standing for being doxed. And also, what you're saying kind of implies that if doxing is no longer much of a big deal, even for people on the right to get doxed, and it's certainly not going to be that much of a big deal for people on the left who have the institutional protection and backing and have more of a social, safety net. Or you could say that the social circles that they move in won't really care. Oh, you got doxxed as a libtard, or you got shamed for saying that you wish Trump had died. Fine. We all agree you're still invited to the wine bar. So this kind of...
Well, actually...
Go ahead.
Yeah, so a big point I want to make here that I was going to get to is the difference in objective versus subjective damage, which I also mentioned in the article. So they might just say, we only get 10% of liberals who are doxxed fired. Well, here's the problem. They're a lot more squeamish than we are. So that's going to hurt more. That's a big problem for them. And two,
yeah, they're more neurotic. Yeah, their neurosis has a multiplier effect.
Yeah, and also there's this thing where they think that they're on a list and the black shirts are going to get them one day. Even though I don't approve of that, that's probably not true. They're kind of neurotic, and it's very uncomfortable feeling that you've been found out, you're on a list. And too, in regards to employment, the long-term effect is hard to measure because do you know, is a reason why you were turned down for an interview, was that because of your docs? It's very hard to find that out because... Well, you'd have to go to discovery, start a lawsuit and start discovery and hope that you can find documentation of that. And there probably isn't. They probably deleted their search history. So good luck with that.
But again, hold on, though. Again, Harvard won't care that a Starbucks employee with an alt or an anon account on Twitter was being a shitlib. This is why I want to focus on being pragmatic. Let's assume that Trav is right, more or less, that we don't have the institutional power to make people's lives miserable. We cannot freeze their bank accounts because we've exposed their opinions or because of a backlash to a joke. It's a rare occurrence that a Hollywood entertainer offends the right, makes a profuse apology and cancels their tour or, you know, cancels their film, whatever, in this sort of apology, kneeling down and begging for forgiveness to our side of things. It doesn't happen very often. So pragmatically speaking, we do need to push back. That's where I disagree with LeBlanc. I do think that normal people are fair targets, including Home Depot cashiers. But let's take all that into account. We don't have institutional backing to really make these people pay the price for their libtardism. We don't get the opportunity to do that also. This kind of stuff, like how often is there going to be an assassination attempt on presidential candidates and former presidents at that matter? You know, so what is something or what are things that we can do to make liberals, make libtards, make these people who are, and also if we can't punch up that, we can't get Tim Wise, we can't get Rachel Maddow. So we do have to think about ways that we can be effective in making the left, quote unquote, you know, these terms increasingly mean nothing, but making diversity zealots and immigration extremists and anti-whites feel uncomfortable. I just don't think that doxing specifically, the conversation has gone into doxing. I don't think that's the most practical way to get these people to feel uncomfortable or to bloody their nose or make them blink, as we were using these metaphors. So what are other ways that we could be doing that?
Well, in the case of the Home Depot cashier, the institution sided with the public and said, this woman does not represent our company, and they fired her. So institutions are concerned with optics. And if a person presents really horrible optics like that, the institution will often side with the public, the right on this particular case. And indeed, the woman got fired. So it depends on the institution. It depends on the historical moment, right? But just imagine Antifa, they're terrible optics. And if you start, and let's just stay with doxing for a while. If you start exposing employees at institutions as Antifa, those institutions might cut them loose. And that would be a good tit for tat thing. If a guy gets fired from a hot dog stand for marching at the Unite the Right rally, why not get one of the Antifa fired from their barista job as a tit for tat thing? That's not a bad thing. The other thing is that I do think we should talk about boycotting though, because that's extremely potentially powerful. And David did some research through the Homeland Institute about the damage caused by the accusation of wokeness compared to the damage caused by the accusation of racism. And racism is the nuclear option in the minds of the left. It's the worst possible thing in the world. And wokeness is almost the equivalent, you know, a dirty word for people on the right now. So David, do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because it does indicate that there is a basis for a broader right-wing cancel culture, and that it does indicate how things like the Bud Light boycott took off, how the Target boycott took off, and the potential for basically destroying businesses and destroying political careers based on the charge of wokeness.
Yes, but I'm going to make a few points first. First, we can chew bubblegum and walk at the same time. There's no cost to us in going after these small people. I know there's a question of whether or not this is a good use of our time and resources, which seem to be scarce. But if you look at movement resources, our only scarce resource seems to be money. We have a lot of people, a lot of time on their hands. And libs of TikTok, we can't direct how they use their time and resources because they're Jewish and therefore not really in with us. 4chan, they're free to accept, or they assign their own tasks to themselves. If 4chan feels like this is not a good use of their time, they're going to stop doing it. That's up to them. I don't think they will. They probably would just be listening to a podcast instead. So we're not really wasting our resources here. In fact, we're putting them to use, and also we're training people. This is training which can be used for other things, I think. So I think this is a good use of our resources. The other thing is that, say if they get in, they're fired from their barista job, they get a new job, that's still an annoyance. It's still a nuisance. There's still anxiety, and they're a lot more fragile than we are, so it's still a win. And two, this kind of segues into what you were saying, Greg. When a company lets an employee go because of pressure, that means that what they're scared about is that customers from the other side of the political spectrum will boycott them. Now, sometimes that's the company enforcing their own ideology upon customer and employee alike. That's often the case on the left, but there's always a fear that, oh no, we're going to be harassed. There might be some monetary thing. And so I think this was a very egregious example, wishing death upon a presidential candidate, but it does show that they are at some level also concerned about a right-wing boycott. They saw what happened to Bud Light. And so this isn't nebulous. They aren't simply willing. They're willing to oftentimes take a hit financially for their ideology, but not always. They're scared. And we can also just kind of meme this into existence and see what happens. I think there is a strong potential for a right-wing boycott. When we did our poll, the first Holman poll ever was on comparing the power of a charge of woke versus a charge of racism. Let's put aside all the problems with the term woke as being nebulous, not getting to the point of being anti-white. It's a common term. It's a term we have to use when talking to normies, because we have to talk to the normies knowing the language they use for the poll. And also if we're trying to organize a mass boycott. If they're about for every 10 liberals who said that they'd pay 10% more, drive an extra mile to boycott a company that's accused of being racist, 7 said that they would do the same for a company that's accused of being woke. That's still a lot of damage. And keep in mind that whites are 70% of the buying power in America, give or take. I think it's like 69%, but that's pretty close. This also varies from company to company, like Home Depot that has more conservative customers probably than Starbucks. So if you pick your, talking about the importance of picking your battles, the battles we should pick aren't on whether the target is high or low in terms of their importance, but rather where they work at. Some companies will be like, say, John Deere. John Deere went full woke and now they're ditching some of their DEI stuff. Why? That's not because they want to, out of love. They love that stuff. It's out of fear or economic cost. I sense blood. I smell blood. I want more. So say if we find someone who's super woke or says other off-color stuff at John Deere, we can get them fired. Say if John Deere has an employee saying that children should be taken from their parents if the parents don't approve of them transitioning. Maybe that's the next step in our escalation. We have to start small. We started small with canceling people wishing death upon Donald Trump. Why not for people who promote extreme gender ideology and grooming children? That's next. Well, I think it's next on the totem pole. So why should we basically find everyone who works at John Deere, find any evidence of that, and see what sticks? Like part of the things with politics and war is being creative and seeing, throwing mud around and seeing what sticks. We don't know. This is completely new. We've never done this before, really, or a very limited effect. So we're still seeing if it works or not. Now, I could be wrong. And if I am, I'll say this: if I'm completely wrong, this backfires, I'll change my position, but I want to at least try it out and see what happens. And two, we're repeating the poll. And one of the things we're asking, and this is important. So in World War I, one of the questions I asked is, would you support a constitutional amendment saying that employees cannot, not a constitutional amendment, a law, saying that employees cannot be fired for exercising a constitutional right outside of work hours? I would like to see the left brought to their knees and made to agree to that. I know in my article I asked, could somebody propose a concrete solution other than developing a counterculture of my own? That is a solution that I wish I had included in the article. The left will never agree to it because that would require them to give up something, but getting nothing in return. It's like World War I. People, both sides are gassing each other with poison gas. Well, If one side had said, please stop, that's mean, they would have kept doing it. For example, the Germans thought that using shotguns in trench warfare was barbaric and basically a war crime. They asked Americans to stop. The Americans laughed and just continued using shotguns. Poison gas is apparently fine. It's how people thought back then. I don't get it, but whatever. Well, after World War I, people said, poison gas is inhumane, but stop using it. Now chemical warfare is a war crime. We're going to, I think, do the same in the culture war. We're going to use our poison gas, do some doxing, until they realize that it's bad for both sides. Maybe it's worse for one side more than the other, but it's not ideal for both. Let's make a treaty where, yeah, we're going to continue the culture war, but we're going to not dox people, or at least make doxing where, sure, you suffer social consequences, but not economic ones regarding employment. And the only way the left will agree to that and give up their equivalent of chemical weapons in the culture war is if we hit them with chemical weapons in the culture war of doxing. That's the only way they're going to agree to this. So yes, I think we need to do this to get this law, see if they will agree to this law.
Yeah, I think that's a very good, valid argument. We have a few questions that have come in. So we can continue with this discussion, but I want to get to these questions. To thank people. Friedrich sends $20. Vance for VP suggests Silicon Valley backs Trump now. This is true. Silicon Valley backs Trump, certainly in the form of Peter Thiel, certainly in the form of Musk. He's sort of broadly Silicon Valley. He sort of comes out of Silicon Valley. His first venture was PayPal with Peter Thiel, and then he expanded into space and automobiles and things like that. So he's part of that milieu. So again, Vance for VP suggests Silicon Valley backs Trump. Do you think that is the case? And if yes, why would Silicon Valley do that? I wanted to ask whether the number of Indians the U.S. is flooded with might be an indication of the establishment found a replacement in the economy, but the CrowdStrike event answered that. Cheers. That is true. That's truly funny. Why would Silicon Valley back Trump? Well, okay. For a long time, the ethos in Silicon Valley was libertarian. It wasn't hard left. It wasn't woke. It was libertarian. And people like Elon Musk have a sort of classical liberal outlook on things, and they are sick to death of the far left. They are sick to death of crazed government programs and things like that. And so I can see why they are inclined towards Trump. Also, I think Silicon Valley has an element, though, of what you can call technocracy. They have an appreciation, let's put it that way. They have an appreciation for government spending on infrastructure and research and development. I think that is clearly something that they get behind. And I think that that's one thing that they hoped that Trump would do. So they're not like radical free marketeers in that sense of libertarian. I think they're classical liberals who believe in a private property economy, but also think that the state should engage in high-tech infrastructure and research and development and stuff like that. And I think they look at Trump as somebody who can bring that. They look, therefore, at globalized capitalism as something that is basically anti-Faustian and anti-high-tech. And that's indeed true, because one of the great things that drove forward technological development in the 20th century was high labor costs. Because labor costs were high, people invested in machines to make people more productive. When we won the Cold War, basically, we stopped doing the massive R&D projects like the space program and Star Wars and things like that, which had great knock-on effects. And also, one of the main disincentives for globalization came down, economic globalization came down. And instead of increasing productivity through technological progress, we started increasing quote-unquote productivity by cost-cutting. And that meant importing cheap labor,
to our shores and offshoring industry to other shores. Basically, cost-cutting rather than technological progress became the driving force of the economy after the end of the Cold War and when globalization went completely crazy. There are people in Silicon Valley who don't relish that situation because they feel like it has undermined the technological dynamism of Western civilization. You can surely see that with somebody like Elon Musk. Peter Thiel's book, Zero to One, talks about this. He has a famous line, "We were promised flying cars by now. Instead, we have 140 characters. Instead, we have smartphones in our pockets to anesthetize and, you know, amuse us as civilization declines around us." That is a reason why people like that support Trump. So I think that they are they're responding to Trump for positive reasons. So that's one reason why I think some people in Silicon Valley support Trump. Again, freedom of speech, also anti-globalization in economics, and that is connected with a desire to get America back on track towards being a leader in technological development. And most technological development, most tech miracles that are touted in the past 30 years have all been connected with computing. It's interesting, for instance, Thiel pointed this out in one of his articles. Air travel is slower today than it was in the 1960s. Why is that? Well, because the whole impetus in aeronautics and the airline industry is towards cost cutting rather than technological improvement. We no longer have the Concorde, right? You know, that's extraordinary. But even without the Concorde, air travel is just slower than it was, cost cutting. One of the greatest films in history was filmed in 1962, Lawrence of Arabia, and 70 millimeter, glorious 70 millimeter. Why didn't that become the standard? Because of cost cutting. It was cheaper to film in 35 millimeter. The results aren't as spectacular, but most people don't notice, and it's cheaper and therefore more profitable. So there's a bad tendency. You know, when cost cutting takes over, technological progress and suffers. So I think that that's definitely one of the reasons why people support Trump, because he's the anti-globalization candidate. So that's a great question. Aaron writes in with $20, any opinions on Vance's Hillbilly Elegy? I honestly haven't read the book. I've just read about it, but we've linked in the chat the Margot Metroland and Jim Goad pieces on it. So I would take a look at that. What they say rings true. I'll take my stand since $10. Thank you. Do you think Trump could still become a distraction that takes more genuinely dissident energy out of the dissident right? Or do you think he will cause more of us? It's always a threat, right? But let's put it this way. This is an argument I hear made all the time, and it's from the naysayers. They look at something that looks as genuine progress, and they think, well, if we make genuine progress, then people will be less unhappy. they'll get happy, and they'll acquiesce to bad trends and things like that. My response to that is, look, if something is genuine progress, we need to take it. We don't win by losing. That's the accelerationist delusion, right? Accelerationism as a strategy basically says, if we just keep losing long enough and hard enough, it'll somehow magically make us win, because we'll just get so mad that we'll just win. It doesn't work that way. It hasn't worked in South Africa, right? So when we see a win, we've got to take it. I think Trump is a win on crucial issues. It's a win on border control, and now mass deportation is within the Overton window as an accepted topic of political discussion. Years ago, when he ran the first time, no one was talking about mass deportation. So this represents progress, and we need to take that. Now, what about the danger, though, that people will think, okay, it's good enough. The heat has been turned down. The frog feels like he's in a nice, you know, hot tub. You know, it's no danger. It's just comfy in here. Come on in. The water's fine, right? What do we do if that danger happens? Well, that's not Trump's fault. It's our fault if we don't, you know, if we don't keep agitating. We have to take some blame here. If people get fat, dumb, and happy, and the frogs are comfortable being slowly boiled, it's our fault for not agitating them. And in the end, only we will save our race, because only we are trying to save our race. Trump can only help us by accident, right? J.D. Vance will only help us by accident. We're the only ones who care about this, and therefore we need to be constantly agitating. And yeah, it's easier when things are getting really, really bad, but it can't just keep getting bad forever or we lose. So we have to take victories where we see them, and then we have to make sure that people want more victories. And my feeling is, though, that if we deported 10 million people from the United States, life would immediately get better in all kinds of ways. It would be immediate, apparent. People would be so much happier that they'd want more. They'd get addicted to it. Let's do 10 more million. Why not 30? There are 50 million of them? Okay, they all need to go. This is why the left is so terrified, because they know that if we get our way, it's a slippery slope. A good slippery slope. It's a slippery slope to a Whitopia, or a reasonable approximation thereof. And that's why they're so terrified. They can't let any good things happen, because the immediate positive results will make people want more and more and more deportation, more and more and more protectionism, more and more border control. Life will just keep getting better and better. So I think that there's little fear that people will want to stop after 10 million. And if they do, we'll just agitate and we'll make a case for making it 20 million and then 30 million. There are probably 50 million people in the United States who have no basis for being there under current law, one way or another. And so imagine if the United States lost that many unwelcome interlopers and competitors for housing and jobs. It would be great for white working people, and they want more. So Friedrich writes in with 10 US dollars. I had to put this in. Do you think Vance's grandmother would have been a better choice for a VP pick? All the best. Vance was talking about his grandmother, how she liked to swear like a sailor. She was a very religious lady, and she had 19 loaded guns in her house when they cleaned it out after her death. And when I heard that, I thought, okay, well, the HAPA perspective vote has been sewn up at this point. Okay. Yeah. K Max McDonald writes in with 10 US dollars. Thank you, folks. This is very generous. Lots of great comments. K Max writes in, was the Republican convention a sort of nightmare for you guys for the first 2 days, at least? An Indian woman leading a Hindu prayer, a black former porn star with prominent speech for 90% white party. Does this feel like a battle already lost? Your thoughts on the convention? Well, we sort of talked about that. It's always going to be this way until we deprogram these people of the crazy idea that there's nothing worse than being accused of being a white person who takes his own side in the fight. And one of the things that we have to emphasize is that the argument that this doesn't help, that we don't actually get black votes or porn star votes or whatever votes by all this pandering, that actually isn't a very powerful argument. Okay. And Sam Francis made this point back in the 90s. And, I've maybe I got it from him, but I was making this point back in 2022. That in the end, it's really all about white people. In this sense, that even if we don't get any votes by pandering to these minorities, they still do it because they're really pandering to themselves, to white voters. They feel that if they don't appease guilty whites by massively signaling that the Dems are the real racists, not them, that they'll lose white voters or the white voters will stay home. And so it really all comes down to white people in the end. They gain more white votes by pandering to blacks than they gain black votes. That's just the sad truth of how utterly decadent our race has become through miseducation, maleducation. Angela, do you want to add something here?
No, yeah, that's. I already spoke my piece about how it was frustrating to watch. It was. I winced. I cringed. I rolled my eyes. And it's just like I was saying earlier too. This is the unique American problem. There is something baked into the American psyche that this is fine. This works. You can have your ostensibly right-wing party inviting brown Hindus to lead a prayer in a foreign language to their native religion, their native gods. You can have a whore, a mystery meat whore with a face tattoo. You can have a WWE wrestler, entertainer. You can have this big show with fireworks and everything. It's just, this is what America has become. It's a problem. And I hate seeing it spread to other parts of the West because I think it's more or less a cancer that, you know, politics is becoming show business and nations are becoming propositional nations, passport nations. You know, it's like I was saying, there's at least, this is why I always hold out hope for the countries in Europe. You know, and even in those countries, there are others that have even more hope. Because whereas this is the thing that's kind of baked into the American psyche, the psyche of a handful of European countries at a very high level, and then just broader, at a broader level, it's more of what I was saying earlier, that the knee-jerk reaction to a Muslim Arab starting a prayer in Arabic or starting a function with a prayer in Arabic caused a knee-jerk reaction of displeasure. So it's a big ask. It's a big challenge to undo this in America, but it is very important that at least, you know, an attempt is made. If America keeps down this road, and it's a road that both parties are playing the Pied Piper, it only leads to doom. It's just only going to end in tears.
Yeah, that's well said. I have a few more donations and questions here. They just keep rolling in. I think this is a very popular subject, obviously. So let me just make sure. Okay, Cockney Nutjob has sent us a diamond, a slog, 15 lemons. Archie has sent a Libri token just now. Trump is the chosen one. I have nothing to add. Yes, 617 Squadron's dog has sent in another donation, $5. Thank you very much. Left-wing cancel culture is nothing new. People got canceled in the 70s, 50s, 30s for racism and sexism. My opinion is all that matters is power. People who are against right-wing cancel culture are like hipsters who stopped following a band after they got signed to a major label. Okay. K-Max McDonald writes in with $25. Trump's Republican convention speech was long, but in general, the panel's view on this racial substance of the speech. That's a question. I still see him using the illegal aliens harm black jobs line, your view of Trump's speech, and then J.D. Vance's speech. I felt Vance spoke much more about white interests. Okay, we did talk a bit about Vance's speech earlier. You're right. He does say more to white people. Trump just does the old, oh, we've done so much for the blacks and all that kind of stuff. It's just hopeless. You know, he has a fossilized boomer brain. He believes this dogma that there's nothing worse than white people taking their own side in a fight. He wants to take out very expensive racism insurance by pandering fanatically. It's just Trump. We just have to accept that. He'll only help us by accident, but he will help us. His speech was long. I didn't listen to the whole thing. I listened to the first 45 minutes of it, and then I listened to excerpts from the rest. For the first half hour or so, when he was talking about the assassination attempt and stuff like that, I thought it was very effective and very heartfelt. Then he was just going all over the place, hitting on various things. I thought it seemed very unfocused, and that's when I tuned out and started, and I'd seen like excerpts from it as well. So those are my thoughts. And K-Max sends another $10, and this is a good question for the panel. Predictions if the Democrats have an open convention, does it have to be a non-white male or female as a nominee if Biden steps down? Does this provide opportunity for us if both president and vice president for Democrats are non-white? The replacement would be seen by millions. I'll say something brief and then I'll hand it to the panel. Years ago, I was so disgusted with John McCain. And later with Mitt Romney, I basically said, you know, I can't bring myself to vote for Barack Obama because that would feel dirty. But I was kind of rooting for him to win. And the reason was is that McCain and later Romney were basically no different on any important issues. They weren't campaigning like Trump was on anti-immigration and anti-globalization, which I thought were big issues. And I thought, well, you know, if we're going to have essentially the same policies and the policies are basically leading to the destruction of the white race in North America, I would rather have a black guy, what we call a black guy, a half black guy, as the president. Why? Because it makes the substance of the regime apparent to people, because people are superficial. If you put a white guy in office who, you know, radiates conservative vibes and has conservative branding and then pursues the great replacement, a lot of people who would otherwise oppose it just go to sleep. So I do think that, yeah, imagine if Carmella becomes the vice, the presidential candidate, and then they go into a convention and they pick some other historic first non-white something or other as a VP. That would be truth in advertising, and that would make the great replacement very, very real. Would they do that? Oh, I don't think these people can help themselves. They really believe this bullshit. They really believe that someone like Kamala Harris is just as good as any white guy who could have been picked by that, you know, for that job. They really believe that. They think that she has bad poll numbers because people are racist and sexist, not because she's an obnoxious idiot. So do I think it's going to happen? I don't know. It's arrogant to say, but my view, okay, I would bet, if I had to bet, I'll bet you the cost of dinner that Joe Biden, because he's a giant asshole. And, you know, there are certain things about dementia that we need to understand here. You lose the stuff that you had, you know, basically it's last hired, first fired, right? The recent stuff is what goes first. And then, you know, you forget the older stuff later and later. So Joe Biden might not remember people that he met yesterday, but he remembers who Joe Biden is. And Joe Biden is an asshole. Joe Biden is an arrogant, pushy, greedy, entitled asshole. And he might have forgotten the debate basically by now, but he hasn't forgotten that he's an arrogant, greedy, corrupt, pushy asshole. And it's going to be very difficult to get to talk him out of running. What would have to happen is the party would basically have to release the compromat files or threaten to do that. And God knows the whole family's corrupt. They didn't call him Pedo Pete for nothing. They would have to do that. And they could do that. And at that point, he would drop out. I don't know if they've gotten that far. And I don't think that if they don't go that far, that Biden will drop out. I just don't think he can be persuaded to drop out. And so I'm betting that he's going to stick around. Unless the panic in the party becomes so big that they basically start threatening his life, or threatening to lock up Hunter, or threatening to lock up the whole family because they're all criminals. I mean, they could go that far if they get that desperate, but I don't think they're there yet. And I don't think they're there because they don't live in reality, right? They still think that they can cheat and finesse and lie and media their way through this problem. David, what are your thoughts on this? Let's talk about just briefly at the end, and we're coming up in 3 hours. Do you think Biden's going to drop? And if he does, what'll happen?
I think he has to drop one way or another. One of the problems is everyone has blackmail on each other, so they can't use it. But what this comes down to is what Jill wants. I think Jill is going to understand that she's not going to become president. She's just going to tarnish her image and Biden's. And it'd be better just to amplify somebody else and go along with the party and just follow her pride, because all the fury directed at the White House right now will be directed at her. If Joe doesn't drop out. So she needs to, if she wants to stay popular, keep her little silly legacy alive, write her stupid book and get some maybe dirty cash from writing a book. She needs to acquiesce to this, even if it galls her soul deeply. So in regards to voting for the other side, I did vote for Obama, and the reason only once, but the reason was because I wanted to, my idea was to completely destroy any excuse for affirmative action, to break the glass ceiling for black people and say, look, we're not racist. What more do you want? You can become president. No more affirmative action. You have no excuse. And I think that's a talking point we should use, is that there was no glass ceiling. They were propped up. That should have been the age when affirmative action ended, but it's only intensified.
Yeah, good point. Angela, what are your thoughts? Do you think Joe is going to drop out? And if so, how and what'll happen?
I don't think so. Predictions are a fool's errand these days, but I tend to remain on team nothing ever happens. So I think he'll stay. I think, you know, it's just too many things to do in too little time if he were to drop out. I really would be surprised if he did, because I just think it'd be logistically and funding wise and it'd be like having to relaunch a campaign with only a few months to actually carry it out. But it's funny watching the Democrats having painted themselves into this corner.
Yeah, they knew he was failing 5 years ago, and they thought, well, you know, we've got the press pulling for us, and you know, we could just massage perceptions and lie, and it'll happen, and we can make it work. And well, it's not working anymore. But I still think a significant number of them feel that they can pull it off. The question really, if Joe can survive the next month, you know, it'll be way too late at that point to drop out, you know, to get rid of him. And at that point, if he's in for another month and then the polls just start going to hell for Democrats down the ticket and stuff like that, they'll be melting down. They'll be freaking out. There's no question about it. But at a certain point, they're not going to be able to get rid of him. And so they've got to act fast. And I just don't know if they can do it or not. My inclination is to think, how to put this? I don't think he can be rationally persuaded to do this. He could be blackmailed, but there would have to be a lot of panic in the party to go that far. I wonder if the panic will set in soon enough to mobilize a consensus to go for the blackmail option before it's too late to change horses at all. I mean, that's the great question that I have. You know, one of the reasons why bad things happen all the time is because people act too late. You know, far-sighted people see this as a problem, and
you know, in a month's time, a lot of people might be saying to themselves, I wish we had listened to so-and-so, but now it's too late. Now we're stuck with this total disaster. It could happen that way.
Another thing too, to keep in mind, is not so much a question of Joe Biden, but also which potential candidate for the Democrat Party would want to be this, this sort of second plate, throw away your political ambitions. Can you try and win a presidential election with 3 months of campaigning? Like, who's going to want to take that on? You know, the ones who are waiting in the wings, who are waiting for, 4 years from now, that have perhaps ambitions on this, they're not going to want to jeopardize those ambitions.
Oh, yeah, that's really true. You'd only get, Carmella, Kabbalah, whatever you want to call her. Carmella, I like Carmella because she's sort of the caramel-colored Kalergi candidate. Yeah, Carmella, the Kalergi candidate, she would go for it because, well, she's the natural person. And it's really would be her only chance because the idea that she could come back in 4 years and have a chance with go through the primary process again. I mean, she was miserable, miserably in the primaries until her race and sex got her plucked, from the absolute bottom of the heap and put in the VP position. So she would have zero chance of a comeback later than this. So she would probably jump on board and she would think, well, the shit libs will go crazy because of the first black woman, yada, yada, yada. And a lot of these people, again, she's a terrible candidate. She's almost as bad as Joe. In fact, in some ways she's worse than Joe. She has less appeal among certain voters than Joe does. Even if he's a vegetable, he's still Scranton Joe, and a certain number of white workers would probably vote for him and just find her obnoxious and stay home. So he might actually be a stronger candidate in some ways than her. But she's the only one who would come forward. She'd claw her way forward because it would be her only chance. But yeah, better candidates would certainly not want to because they think, I just be dooming my political career by doing this. Which she could, she would grab it and then she'd try and do something stupid like, I don't know, she'd think, I know, I'll have a white guy in the VP position and then put Pete Buttigieg in, right? Yeah, because he would be a historic first too, right? And that ticket I could just see really bombing. But again, these people believe the affirmative action bullshit. And beyond that, even if it fails, they still feel righteous. They'll still say, we did the right thing, but Americans are too sexist and racist and homophobic to do the right thing. And they'd feel really self-righteous about it. So it's almost a win-win for these people. If they win, they win. And if they lose, they can feel superior. Mm-hmm. I think they're going to have to lose and feel superior. I just think it's, and I think, whether it's Joe at the top of the ticket or Kabbalah, I think they're just going to lose. Let's just see if there are any more final questions here, and then we shall wrap up. This has been a marathon session, but it's a lot of fun. Man in a Suitcase, Dr. Nail's best-selling author of The Indoctrinated Brain, gave a presentation at the 2024 International Cooperation Forum in front of 1,500 NGO and government reps from over 100 countries on the benefits of small-dose lithium on mood at the population level. Sinister can save for next week if you like. He sends $5. Thank you for that. Actually, he sends two donations of $5 with the same question. Well, thank you. And that's doubled. You doubled the question and then the amount will be doubled too. That's an interesting question. I don't know what to think about this. We did have a review of the Indoctrinated Brain book by Michael Walker at Countercurrents recently. You might look at that.
But yeah, I mean, if they want to put, I swear they're going to try and put us all on drugs to, you know, it's the only way that they're going to make the new world order work is just to put us all on drugs to damage our brains, basically. And then there's been talk of this. It's like, oh, if you damage people's brains, they won't be ethnocentric anymore. They've actually talked about this kind of stuff. I think it's very, very interesting. I don't think it's going to happen, but it's a dystopian possibility. We just have to get these bastards out of power before they resort to something like that. So anyway, let's wrap up. Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. Take the Soma, bigot, one of our commentators says. I like that. So, David, how do people follow your work?
Yes, you can follow me on Twitter or X. It's David Zutty. It's pretty easy to find, Z-S-U-T-T-Y, because it's a unique name. I, of course, also write for Countercurrents. Also began posting my articles on Substack, so you can follow me there. And while my opinions are my own, I am the executive director of the Homeland Institute, and that is homelandinstitute.org.
Great, thank you. And Angelo, how do people follow your work?
Of course, I write on Countercurrents, and you can also follow me on the Pax Populi Substack. There's some extra articles over there, sort of, I guess, exclusive ones. And then I'm on X and Telegram and all that. And also, you can catch me as the presenter of the New Nationalism podcast, which has just premiered last week, I think. And then
2 weeks ago, I think. Yeah.
2 weeks ago. Okay. Yeah, there'll be more episodes coming soon. So people can also check out the New Nationalism podcast on Substack and Spotify.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Next week, a week from today, we will be back with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. It will be the Countercurrents Book Club. And the book of the month will be Being and the Birds by Derek Hawthorne. It's a fascinating book about Alfred Hitchcock's movie The Birds, using the lens of Martin Heidegger's philosophy to interpret it. I think it's the best book I've ever read about the birds. And one of our blurbs by Martin Lichtmetz says it even outdoes Camille Paglia's little book on the birds, which I thought was a masterpiece. So we are going to have the author, Derek Hawthorne. We are going to have Martin Lichtmetz, and we're going to have James O'Meara discussing Being in the Birds next week on the Countercurrents Book Club. You can get that as an ebook instantly if you want to read up and ask questions. I think it's a brilliant book. I think it's a brilliant interpretation of a great movie. And also, it works really well as a first encounter, a first introduction to Heidegger. So it's a doubly useful book, and it's well written and just fascinating. So tune in next week. And in the meantime, keep on reading Countercurrents. And thank you all for your donations and the chat. It's been really, really enjoyable. And we will be back. Thank you.